You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 1st of May, 2013, on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24. We're live from Studio One in London with me, Dominic Reynolds, and Phil Hahn.
Coming up in the next 60 minutes, we set the news agenda with the top three stories you'll need to know for the next 24 hours. Joining us now is Dr. James Boyes from King's College London. James, what do you have for us?
Morning, guys. Well, this morning I want to talk about how the agenda of today is set by the shadows of the past, including hunger strikes at Gitmo, red lines in Syria, and Putin celebrating the new heroes of labour in Russia.
Also coming up, finding balance in the West Bank. We get the inside story on independent news organisation that's gathering the trust of Palestinians.
And we start Ma'an, in the Arabic Ma'an, that means together. And how the Palestinians, they were interesting to saw their agendas. They were like, okay, what's going on in Palestine? And we would like to hear that from the Palestinian.
Backstabbing, secrecy and betrayal. Welcome to the glorious world of morning television in the United States.
She had been dreaming about getting that job for 15 years. She had been groomed for it. Viewers had been rooting for her to get the job. And the way they removed her was devastating. They did the right thing the wrong way.
Also, we head to Cairo to find out why Egypt has walked out of nuclear non-proliferation talks.
All that plus we'll play some music as well and review today's Australian front pages. That's all to come in the next hour here on Midori House.
Really? Just an hour? That's an awful lot for an hour, isn't it, Phil?
It's a lot, but we're gonna jam it in. It's going to be a good one, I think.
Let's do it then. 2 minutes past 8 a.m. here in London. Let's start, as ever, with the news headlines. Here's Barney Burnham.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Barney Burnham. Three British soldiers and nine Afghan troops have been killed in a roadside bomb attack in Helmand Province. The families of the dead Britons have been informed. The Ministry of Defence says the men were airlifted to the military hospital at Cambastian, but doctors were unable to save them. 444 UK servicemen and women have died in Afghanistan since the campaign began in 2001. Six have died this year. The Hezbollah leader, Syed Hassan Nasrallah, has warned that Syrian rebels fighting the forces of President Assad will not be able to topple him by force. In a televised speech from an undisclosed location, Nasrallah, who's a staunch Assad ally, said Syria's allies in the region and the world would not allow it to fall into the wrong hands. Rebels have accused Hezbollah of fighting alongside Assad's forces. The group has formally denied the allegation, saying it was only fighting to protect Shiite villages along the border. But Nasrallah gave the strongest indication so far that his group was involved in fighting inside the country by admitting that some fighters had been killed in Syria. The Oxfam chief executive Mark Goldring has visited the Za'atari refugee camp in the north of Jordan, which is home to 100,000 Syrian refugees. It's become increasingly difficult for camp officials to provide services and basic necessities for the refugees. Mr. Goldring's visit came as the organisation issued a report warning that 7 million people are affected by the war in Syria.
We're calling on the international community in two main ways. The first has got to be to pressurise Syria to allow humanitarian access full and free within Syria. The second issue we're looking for is the international community to actually provide the money which is needed to help the governments of Jordan, Lebanon.
President Obama has defended the handling of the Boston Marathon bombing investigation. He said federal law enforcement officials and others appear to have done their jobs correctly, amid questions about how the attackers managed to detonate their bombs, killing three people. The president added that he's asking his counter-terrorism team to look at what more can be done to detect threats from people who become self-radicalized.
What I can say is that based on what I've seen so far, the FBI performed its duties. Department of Homeland Security did what it was supposed to be doing. But this is hard stuff.
The lawyer for the widow of the Boston Marathon bombing suspect, Tamil Ansaneyev, says she wants a medical examiner to release his remains to the Tsarnaev family in southern Russia. Investigators have questioned Catherine Russell as they seek clues about how Tsarnaev and his younger brother Zhokhar allegedly built the bombs and whether they had help. It's been reported that traces of female DNA were found on the bombs. The 24-year-old widow, who returned to her family in Rhode Island days after the blast, has spent hours meeting FBI agents at her home and her lawyer's office in Providence. A US Army major and his wife have been arrested and charged with child endangerment for physically abusing their three foster children and forcing their three biological children to help cover up the abuse. Prosecutors say Major John Jackson and his wife Carolyn engaged in a conspiracy between August 2005 and April 2010 to abuse the three children they fostered and later adopted. One of the three adopted children died in 2008, but it's not immediately clear how. Prosecutors say two of them were forced to eat red pepper flakes, hot sauce and raw onion as punishment. New Jersey U.S. Attorney Paul Fishman says the parents didn't give them enough water.
The biological children we use effectively as disciplinarians, trying to keep, for example, one of the adopted children from drinking water from a toilet when that child was so thirsty there was no other place to get water.
Those are the main stories here on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Mr. Barney Burnham. Barney will be back in about 24 minutes with another check of the world headlines. It's 6 minutes past 8 o'clock in the morning here in London. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
This is Midori House. We are live in London and the time is 7 minutes past 8 in the morning. And that means, loyal listener, as you quite know already, that it's time to set the day's agenda. That means we're going to be choosing three big stories that you need to know about in the next 24 hours.
And today we are lucky to have Dr. James Boyes, visiting senior research fellow at King's College London and Monocle regular contributor. He joins us now in the studio. Thanks very much, James, for coming in.
Good morning. Always a pleasure, guys.
You've got a bunch of really interesting stories, but let's start things off with Guantanamo Bay, shall we?
Why not? I think my stories today are generally covered by the idea of the shadows of the past. And in the week that's seen the opening of the George W. Bush Presidential Library in Texas, it seems incredible that Barack Obama is still having to deal with the ramifications of the Bush presidency. But here we are. Guantanamo Bay was something that President Obama campaigned against, promised it to close, and has been unable to do so. A lot of people have criticized him for this. It's important to note that he's been prohibited from doing so by Congress, which hasn't made life easy. But he's facing issues this week with regard to hunger strikes there. The UNHCR is suggesting this is a violation of human rights, for example. And I think it's very problematic. Those of us who are very pro the United States and advocate a close relationship with the US, I think the problem is if this was anybody else, if this was the Soviets in the old Cold War system, for example, or the Chinese who we were hearing about keeping a prison camp open without keeping anybody trial, for example, for 10 years and force feeding people, I think we'd have a slightly different view of this, and it's problematic at best.
It's embarrassing, isn't it?
It's terrible.
On the one side, there's a president who can't do one of the sort of banner policies of his first election campaign, and on the other side, it's the idea of their sort of moral superiority is hugely blemished by the very fact that it still exists.
This is one of the great problems. I think the United States, you know, tends to get hoisted on its own petard a great deal. It talks an awful lot about its aspirations and its moral superiority in many cases. And most of the time, I think there's a degree of truth to that. But every now and again, something will come along like this, which calls it into question. This idea of American exceptionalism, of course, which Obama has been had problems with himself, quite frankly. But how do you sort out a problem like this when you've got members of Congress who are vehemently opposed to it and refuse and now prohibit people from Gitmo being returned back to the United States? It's very, very difficult. It can't just be solved with an executive order, for example, as some people have suggested.
Absolutely. Obama called this yesterday during a press conference a moral imperative. He said it was unsustainable that Gitmo remains open. But even people within his own party, it seems, are unwilling to really go along and help push for the closing of Gitmo. Is that the case?
Yeah, it's really difficult because I think in Europe it's very easy to fall into a stereotype and say good liberal Democrats, evil Republicans. But of course, one of the challenges is, as you well know, this isn't a straight left-right debate. You know, there's this idea of blue dog Democrats. You have some members of the Democratic Party who are almost more right-wing than some Republicans in some parts of the country. It's such a diverse nation. So it's not even as though Obama can count upon his own party to support him in this. They are people who fundamentally say, you know what, these people should not be left back into the United States, even into the most high security prisons in the country. What that says about the state of American prison security is another question, however.
I mean, it feels like an argument that doesn't take place on the sort of left-right political spectrum, but almost now is on a sort of vertical time spectrum of history, then and now. And we've got the sort of past being dragged into the present in this way. And you are an expert on the US and follow the US and want it to have a sort of respectable position in the world as much as possible. And I wonder how concerning things like this in the same week as that great photo opportunity where you see the two previous Bushes in there, how sort of reputationally damaging it is.
Yeah, I think it is. I think what's fascinating is the degree to which Obama seems to be getting a pass from, I hate to use this expression, the media. I think that if this had been continuing, if Bush had a third term or a fourth term, if he could have been constitutionally allowed to do so, and this was still open, you know, people around the world would be up in arms about it. And for some reason, Obama just seems to be getting away with it. And his reputation internationally, certainly in Europe at least, doesn't seem to be taking a hit on it. What it's doing for America long term, I think, is another matter, however. And I think that there will be people who will be calling this into question and saying, well, hang about, 10 years on, what does it say about the power of the presidency and Obama's executive capacity that he can't get stuff like this through? And also we move into areas to do with gun control legislation. You know, if you can't get that sort of thing passed in the wake of the events that we've seen during his time in office, what does it say about his executive authority?
Well, let's focus on Obama's credibility there. Syria, 2 years on, 70,000 people dead, reports of chemical weapons, another massive bombing in Damascus yesterday in the capital. Has that, he talks about this red line and the red line being crossed with chemical weapons, but now it seems like he's trying to backtrack on those statements?
Yeah, there's no doubt about it. I think what was fascinating that he called this press conference yesterday, seemingly out of the blue, no one was necessarily waiting for it. And I thought, well, you know, what's he going to say? Is it going to be something dynamic? And not really. It was just almost like a talking point. And you thought, well, you know, this is, you know, you call a press conference as the president of the United States to say something, not just to have a conversation with the press necessarily. You know, the whole thing's starting to remind me a bit of something that happened when Clinton was president. You might recall there was the Rwanda genocide, except, of course, it wasn't a genocide, because if they'd called it a genocide, nations would have been legally obliged to act. So what do they call it? Acts of genocide. And this is starting to sound a little bit similar to what's going on here in Syria, of course. Obama called, as you rightly say, for these red lines that couldn't be crossed. An awful lot of people now coming out saying there have been chemical weapons used. Now the White House is sort of humming and hawing and saying, well, yes, maybe, possibly, yes, maybe, who knows? We don't know who, by, where, and to what quantities. You know, when these things have been used in the past, they've been, you know, for example, when Saddam used them, there were whole villages that were, you know, eradicated effectively, and that was very clear. Now nobody seems to know or want to admit who's using them and under what circumstances. We've also heard this week, of course, in the last 24 hours, that Hezbollah are now coming out and saying, hey, you get involved, you're in a world of pain, effectively. So there's no doubt that Obama desperately wants not to get involved in Syria. They're worried to death about arming the rebel groups. You don't want to get into a blowback situation whereby you arm a group of people who then come to power and then end up coming against the United States and using those very weapons against you in future battles.
And we've certainly seen that numerous times in the past. Of course, that on that Hezbollah issue, I mean, it wasn't looking like the stalemate was about to be resolved, but it's looking even less likely that that's likely to be resolved now, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so. I think the problem you've got ultimately is that you've got a battle going on within Syria. It's clearly becoming more and more dangerous. You know, we've seen assassination attempts just in the last week or so with regards to the leadership there. The United States desperately doesn't want to get involved. You know, if Assad falls and a group come to power, despite the abject lack of support from the quote-unquote the West, where does that put the new leadership in Damascus in terms of its orientation? It's not going to help anybody in the long term, I don't think.
And it isn't just the domestic issues within Syria that people need to worry about. There are obviously some external factors as well, namely Russia's relationship with Syria as well as Iran. On that Hezbollah issue, Hassan Nasrallah, he stated that Russia and Iran would not let Assad be defeated and they would intervene. How much of a factor is that?
It has a huge impact. I mean, whether one wants to take these words at face value is another issue. But if you think about how it is that those sorts of issues have prevented interactions in the past, just go back to the 90s, for example, when the West, the United States and Britain wanted to intervene in Bosnia, for example. And one of the main reasons it couldn't was because it was going to get any actions vetoed by the Russians at the Security Council. Well, you've got the same thing happening, arguably, with regard to Syria now, with Russia and China vetoing any UN mandate there. You've got the same sort of thing coming through, which is going to prevent action. So this idea of historical ties preventing the doing of the right thing, as it would be seen from the West necessarily, is certainly something which has ramifications today. And again, it's an example of the past impacting the present and the future.
And I suppose we've got to ask questions about the connection or the happiness that Russia and Iran may or may not have with Hezbollah, almost by proxy, making this sort of statement without them having to say anything. But before we leave you, James, I just want to talk about one extra subject you've brought out for us, which is May Day in Russia. We were talking earlier about what's going to be going on in Egypt and lots of potential problems happening for Mohamed Morsi. What's Putin got to face today?
Well, since we talked about the ghosts of the past and Russia, it's interesting now that Vladimir Putin, who's someone who very much wants to bring back, I think, a sense of national pride, and who's talked about, you know, the national tragedy of the collapse of the Soviet Union, is now talking about bringing back, and is in fact bringing about, this idea of the hero of the socialist labor movement within within Russia. Of course, May Day in the past, we've seen great parades of SS-20 missiles through Red Square. I think it's unlikely we'll see that today, I hope. But the idea of trying to restore a sense of Russian pride, it's fascinating who it is that they're looking at honouring, because, of course, in the past, it would be heroes of the Soviet Union. Who are the heroes of the Russian people today? Is it oligarchs, for example? I'm going to have to be very careful about what I say here, because there's an awful number of people who've ended up falling foul of Putin here in the great city of London. So perhaps we should
stay away
time
from sushi
on
bars.
Yeah, absolutely, and cups of tea. So it's a dangerous area, quite clearly.
James, you're in safe hands, though. Many thanks,
thank
as ever. It's been a great pleasure having you on.
Now, coming up, we're going to have a special report into the Palestinian News Organization looking for balance in the West Bank.
A 10-minute drive from downtown Hong Kong is an industrial estate that has evolved into a neighborhood. Monocle Films goes inside its warehouse towers to discover artists, designers, and retailers, creating a community.
At the moment, we are making it the place that we would like it to be by bring in the people that we think are adding value to the area.
A cinematic portrait of Chai Wan, Hong Kong's industrial wasteland turned good. Now playing in the Films menu on monocle.com.
Welcome back to Midori House with me, Phil Hahn, and Dominic Reynolds. In the West Bank city of Bethlehem, Manhan News is quietly providing a fresh perspective on one of the world's most contested conflicts through a mix of on-the-ground reporting and thoughtful programming that highlights the Palestinian perspective. Manhan has emerged as one of Palestine's most trusted and independent news organizations.
So in a land where virtually every action has a political reaction and every event can be seen from two opposing angles, how hard is it to make news that you can really call reliable? Well, Monocle's Jerusalem correspondent Joseph Dana visited the headquarters to find out about Palestine's changing media landscape.
A short walk from Bethlehem's Manger Square, a nondescript building adorned in Jerusalem stone, is the headquarters of Ma'an News Agency. Phones constantly ring as editors and reporters huddle over flashing computers in a dense cloud of cigarette smoke. Born out of the idea of giving Palestinians their own media voice, Ma'an has grown to become one of the most respected Palestinian media organizations.
During the Second Intifada, it was very complicated to contact each other in the Palestinian territories and the Palestinian areas, and we think, let's do something like together.
That is Mohammed Falsi, Ma'an's production manager and news editor.
And we start Ma'an, and in the Arabic, Ma'an, that means together. And how the Palestinians, they were interesting to show their agendas. Not Al Jazeera agenda, not Al Arabi agenda, not the Israelis satellite TV, whatever. They were like, okay, what's going on in Palestine? And we would like to hear that from the Palestinian.
The Palestinian perspective is often lost in the haze of breaking news from the region. In 2005, Ma'an created a radio station, television channel, as well as English and Arabic websites to fill this void. It is now one of the largest independent media groups in the West Bank and Gaza. I met George Hale at a sidewalk cafe in Bethlehem. He is the managing editor of Ma'an's English language operations.
The media climate in Israel and Palestine is one of the most, if not the most, saturated in the world. Despite this, there's a lack of attention to the day-to-day issues that are actually facing Palestinians. The coverage tends to be about politics or about conflict, and there's really not another outlet that's like Ma'an in the way that covers issues on the ground from a local perspective and for a local audience as well. So we report on things that would never occur to most journalists because they don't have the same responsibility and they don't have the same audience.
Ma'an's strength lies in its extensive network of journalists working in every corner of Palestine, from sleepy West Bank villages to the tunnels on the Gazan-Egyptian border. Ma'an's deep network of reporters are faced with the unusual challenge of operating under two different governments, one ruled by the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank and one by Hamas in Gaza. Ala al-Din al-Abed is the news editor of Ma'an's television news channel.
In West Bank, we can cover everything we want. We just catch any fault from the Palestinian Authority side, government, police. We can cover it, everything in West Bank. And the other example in Gaza Strip, no, we cannot working as what we are looking for. Because if you're making something good, as they feel, if the Hamas government in Gaza Strip, they will accept you. If you say anything or do anything against them, they will be very angry, and maybe it will be very dangerous for us to just cover it.
شباب من مختلف أطيافهم السياسية وسنواتهم العمرية.
Ma'an's latest venture is a reality program called The President. The hit show pits 25 young Palestinians against each other in a race to become the next president of Palestine. In the course of each episode, contestants are forced to provide solutions for the pressing issues facing Palestinians. Riyad Atman, the show's producer, explains the process.
So all the questions will be focused about the political system in Palestine, not now also, but also in the future. For example, if we will have a Palestinian state, is PLO will stay there or not? If, for example, if somebody says, I don't want election, like what's happening now in Hamas, and you are the president, what your decision will be and why? These kind of questions will let us read the street of the youth in the next 10 years. How is the Palestinian thinks? And maybe some of the answers will be a solution for the higher political people.
The president is an attempt by Ma'an's leadership to strike a balance between getting stuck in the daily minutiae of the ongoing Israeli-Palestinian conflict and the concerns of average Palestinians. The balance is a delicate one. Mohammed Falsi, again.
It's a kind of conflict. Each morning we have like round the table and we discuss where we are going, but you know, the situation, you can't avoid that there is occupation and there is Israel, because Israel involved in everything. In water, in sport, in moving, in transportation, in traveling, in the borders. This is part of our life. We have to decide now to follow who, because the media, this is very powerful weapon in our hand, and the media, the most important things to communicate and to guide your people, because the people here, they believe in media.
Ma'an has become an indispensable resource for anyone interested in coverage that provides a window into life in Palestine. The organization is a testament to the power of local media, to embolden people through the simple act of honest storytelling, without the need for sensational social media noise. Ultimately, its reporting serves as a powerful reminder that the greatest insights into a society are often entwined with the ordinary grind of daily life, even in the middle of one of the world's most entrenched conflicts. From Monocle, in Bethlehem, I'm Joseph Dana.
And Joseph joins us on the line now. Joseph, welcome back to Midori House. I thought it might be interesting, seeing as we have you here. It was a really interesting package there. I thought we could have a look at some of the stories that the agency has been covering in the last 24 hours. The most saturated media landscape on earth, we heard there. What are some of the things they've been talking about?
Well, yesterday in the West Bank and in Gaza, it was actually quite a busy day. There was a terror attack. A Palestinian stabbed an Israeli at a West Bank kind of checkpoint in the middle of the territory, the first such attack in about a year. And so Ma'an was very much on top of this. This story was broke in the Israeli media, but what Ma'an did, because of its extensive network of journalists on the ground, was able to kind of cover the aftermath of what was going on. So after this kind of horrific attack happened, a number of Israeli settlers throughout the territory kind of rebelled, and Ma'an was really the organization covering these ongoing developments that went deep into the night. And what's always interesting about Ma'an's coverage is that you can see traces of it in AP and Reuters coverage as well. So oftentimes they will be the first people on the scene in the West Bank, and then Reuters and AP and the other international bureaus will then jump on their coverage and kind of expand on it. And so I think that's really their strength.
I just wanted to build on that point, Joseph. Ma'an, obviously very region-specific, but how much is there a sense that other news organizations, international news organizations, are now starting to rely on Ma'an as kind of their source there on the ground?
Well, we've seen this really develop. You know, Ma'an is a relatively new news organization. It's basically been going since 2005, and 2009 is really when it kicked up its English language operations. And so once that English language website got out there, you could really trace a direct line between the stories they were breaking, oftentimes first and, you know, kind of unusual stories that international journalists just wouldn't have the local knowledge to kind of find. So a line between those stories and then the coverage of the main international bureaus. And I know personally from a number of journalist colleagues here on the ground that Ma'an is one of the first sources that we look at, you know, when we wake up in the morning to kind of find out what's going on and to pursue our own stories. And so it's really become indispensable from a kind of journalism perspective.
You spent some time, as we heard in that piece, looking around how they work. And I wonder, given that highly saturated news environment, given that so much of the coverage is dedicated towards the issues of conflict, how much does Ma'an have a responsibility to almost be reactive to what other news organisations in the region are doing, to look at what they're covering and say, well, we've got a responsibility to do something else?
I believe that there is a certain sentiment that does exist, because Ma'an is a Palestinian news organization. And so they feel, as we heard in the package, they feel as though the Palestinian voice kind of needs to be out there. But more than that, a lot of what they're doing is actually quite simple, is that they live in Bethlehem mostly. They're all over the West Bank and Gaza. And so they report on the stories that they see. Most of the international press is based in Jerusalem. And so they're getting the Palestinian news kind of from afar. They kind of jump into Ramallah or they jump into Nablus to find out what's going on, and then they go home to Jerusalem. And so that's not the case for Ma'an. So a lot of their kind of method, a lot of their kind of secret is just to kind of have their eyes on the ground in the cities in which they live, which unfortunately, given this saturated media climate, just really isn't there. And again, that's what makes them so unique.
And Joseph, just very briefly, we heard there in your package that they currently have a reality TV show of sorts called The President. The Ma'an news organization online gets about 3 million visitors a month. Is there any sense that they may even potentially be looking into developing a video service or potentially working with television organizations to create some kind of a news show?
Well, I believe that there is this kind of aspiration for bigger things. You know, while I was there over the weekend reporting this story, they were all very adamant about the facelift that is coming to their website. Their website is kind of rudimentary, let's say, and they're really kind of realizing the potential that they have in this very saturated market. And so I expect to see Ma'an's brand, Ma'an's voice, become that much more profound, because like I said, journalists, the people that are making the news here for the international media, know and respect Ma'an's coverage, and so they're kind of becoming hip to the fact that they actually have a niche space that they can occupy. And so I expect to see a new website, perhaps new programming. The President has become a very popular show, and that could spread to the Arab world. And so I think that there's a lot of big things on the horizon for Ma'an News Agency.
Fascinating stuff, Joseph. Joseph Dana there in Ramallah, many thanks for your time. News in just a moment, but before we do that, this is Ce Soir J'aime Vais by Jacqueline Taieb. Je ne t'oublierai pas, et quand je reviendrai à Londres, ce sera surtout pour toi. Dans ton pays merveilleux, nous avons été heureux. Je t'écrirai dès demain. Angleterre, c'est pas bien loin. Je t'assure, je reviendrai. Ce soir, je m'en vais by Jacqueline Taieb. But don't worry, we're staying right here.
Very good French, Dominic.
I'm very impressed.
Of course.
In the next half hour of the program, we'll leaf through the Australian front pages with our associate business editor. Our man on the ground in Cairo will bring us news from Egypt, and we'll dive into the murky world of America's morning television.
She had been dreaming about getting that job for 15 years. She had been groomed for it. Viewers had been rooting for her to get the job. And the way they removed her was devastating. They did the right thing the wrong way.
But first, here is Barney Burnham with the news headlines.
Thanks, Phil. Three British soldiers and nine Afghan troops have been killed in a roadside bomb attack in Helmand province. The Ministry of Defence says the men were airlifted to the military hospital at Camp Bastion, but doctors were unable to save them. The Hezbollah leader Syed Hassan Nasrallah has warned that Syrian rebels fighting President Assad's forces will not be able to topple him by force. In a televised speech from an undisclosed location, Nasrallah, who's a staunch ally of the president, said Syria's allies in the region and the world would not allow it to fall into the wrong hands. President Obama has defended the handling of the Boston Marathon bombing investigation. He said federal law enforcement officials and others appear to have done their jobs correctly. He added that he's asking his counterterrorism team to look at what more can be done to detect threats from people who become self-radicalized. The lawyer for the widow of the Boston Marathon bombing suspect, Tamil Ansaneyev, says she wants a medical examiner to release his remains to the Tsarnaev family in southern Russia. A US Army major and his wife have been arrested and charged with child endangerment for physically abusing their three foster children and forcing their three biological children to help cover up the abuse. Prosecutors say Major John Jackson and his wife Carolyn engaged in a conspiracy between August 2005 and April 2010 to abuse the three children they fostered and later adopted. Those are the headlines at the bottom of the hour here on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much, Barney. You are back with Midori House on Monocle 24, with me, Dominic Reynolds, and Mr. Phil Hahn. Now, betrayal, mystery, and intrigue. Sounds like a daytime soap opera, doesn't it?
Sounds like our show.
Well, that may be pertinent, in fact, Phil. In fact, this is the world of morning television in the United States. So very different from morning radio in Britain, of course. And it is one of the most competitive media markets on the planet, of course, and a successful morning show can raise more than $500 million in ad revenue every year.
It's also an intensely secretive world of TV executives, focus groups, and of course, the egos of on-screen talent. Center at all of this, those dreaded Nielsen ratings. But a new book called Top of the Morning by New York Times media reporter Brian Stelter hopes to shed light on this often shady world. I caught up with Brian from our New York bureau and began by asking him to set the scene for the Battle of Battles that takes place every morning at 7 a.m.
Well, Today Show was essentially the first morning show on any network in any country. It invented the concept of morning TV in the 1950s, and for most of the time since, it has been the number one morning show in the United States. The shows that came out after it, like ABC's Good Morning America, have always been trying to get to first place. And GMA, as it's known on ABC, has beaten the Today Show a few times, but for the most part, the Today Show has been on top for most of the last 60 years.
Many people credited Jeff Zucker, the former executive producer of the Today Show, with that meteoric climb. But things were starting to go a bit downhill in the last couple of years. Tell us about when Meredith Vieira left and the real search to replace her and how that actually went.
Right. The Today Show started this amazing streak in 1995, this winning streak that had gone on for 15 years by the time Meredith Vieira decided in 2011 to step down from the show. The Today Show is really proud of its transitions between anchors, between, for example, Matt Lauer and Brian Gumbel back in the 1990s, between Katie Couric and Meredith Vieira in the mid-2000s. And this transition from Meredith Vieira to someone else was also taken very seriously in 2011. After all, the Today Show was winning in the ratings, but Good Morning America on ABC was starting to edge closer to it. So the pressure was on NBC to pick the right replacement. NBC went with Ann Curry, who had been the news anchor for about 15 years on the show. She was a trusted member of the Today Show family. Viewers knew her and loved her, but she wasn't the right fit in that co-anchor chair, that most important chair on the show. Things really went badly even from the beginning for her, and looking back, it seems like she was undermined the whole time she had the job.
You really do go into some very
minute details in terms of just the relationship she had with Matt Lauer, how awkward it is, how uncomfortable they both seemed on air. Explain some of that awkwardness.
Yeah, so here are Matt Lauer and Ann Curry anchoring the most important show on NBC, something worth $500 million in revenue every year for the network, a network that was struggling at other times of day, but still number one. That's the backdrop for Ann Curry and Matt Lauer, who didn't seem to be able to play together the same way that Matt Lauer was able to play with Katie Couric and able to play with Meredith Vieira. One executive of the network said to me, it was as if Matt Lauer would serve the tennis ball, so to speak, over the net to Ann Curry, and he never knew in what way Ann was going to hit it back. It was unpredictable, it was uncertain, and as a result, he just stopped playing altogether, and that made the show even worse. That made it seem like they had no chemistry at all. In morning TV, it's all about chemistry, and Ann Curry and Matt Lauer just didn't seem to have any.
And that's when you go into the book with something you called Operation Bambi. It's the first chapter in the book. And that's when you go into some very specific details. You're really ripping into the NBC team there, namely Matt Lauer, Jim Bell, the ex-NBC News president, Steve Capus, at the way they went about it.
That's right. NBC did the right thing in 2012 by deciding to remove Ann Curry from the job that they had given her just a year earlier. They were doing the right thing. Pretty much everybody agrees Ann Curry was not the right anchor next to Matt Lauer on the Today Show. But she had been dreaming about getting that job for 15 years. She had been groomed for it. Viewers had been rooting for her to get the job. And the way they removed her was devastating. They did the right thing the wrong way.
So do you think there has been some criticism of the book saying that you go a bit too far against Matt Lauer and that in one way you almost seem to have a vendetta against him in this book? How do you react to that type of a reaction?
I've been really surprised by it because I think the book is not only very fair to NBC and to Matt Lauer, it's also rather conservative. It tries to understate how devastating this transition was. And I look back now, I read it, and I think I probably should have used stronger language to describe what happened, because when we look back and now, after almost a year later, we know that about $50 million in advertising revenue was lost because of this. We know that Matt Lauer's Q score dropped about 50%. This is the Q score is something that's taken deadly seriously in the TV industry. It's a measure of how likable and appealing an anchor is. And his Q score dropped the way almost no Q score ever drops. Clearly, viewers punished Matt Lauer for Ann's removal. Whether it was his fault or not, viewers blamed him for it. And unfortunately, that's something he predicted would happen ahead of time. He saw this coming, but he couldn't stop it. But looking back, I think not only the book was very, very fair to Matt Lauer, I think it's sympathetic because it presents the conundrum, the predicament that he was in, knowing that this was probably going to hurt him, but watching it happen anyway.
So you just said there that you would use stronger language potentially.
Yeah, if I could go back and rewrite it now, I suppose, because I was having to write this book in the fall before it was really clear just how damaging this transition was.
So give us an idea of just how much further you would go then.
Well, looking back now, it's clear that Ann Curry and Matt Lauer's fates were and still are intertwined. And that's not something that I said directly in the book. It is something I tried to say directly in the magazine preview of the book that came out in the New York Times Magazine earlier this month. I wasn't fully aware of just how tied together they were. But when you look at Ann Curry's Twitter feed or Facebook feed or Instagram feed now, today, 9 months after she was removed, you'll still see fans attacking Matt Lauer. I find it amazing because personally, I've moved on. I think a lot of people have moved on. But clearly Ann Curry's fans, her passionate fans, have not. And that's partly because NBC never fully explained why they did what they did. You know, there's often that expression, it's not the crime, it's the cover-up. Well, there wasn't a crime committed here, but it was the covering up of the decision that really did the most damage, because NBC never came out and said, this is why we're doing it, it's the right thing to do, and we take responsibility. By not addressing it, they probably made a bad situation worse.
Let's look at the state of morning television now in the United States. NBC's Today Show lost the top spot after 16 years winning that morning slot. The state of the Today Show now, Matt Lauer is still there. They have Savannah Guthrie as his co-host. Do you foresee the Today Show being able to fight back against a real climb against Good Morning America, which has come away as the winner?
I do. I think the Today Show is primed for a comeback now. That's how these shows work. It's as if they're on a seesaw, back and forth, Today and GMA, always striving either to be number one or, once they're there, to stay number one. The Today Show's streak, its 16-year-long streak, was really an anomaly in the 1990s and 2000s, and I don't think we're ever going to see a streak that long again. I think the Today Show is going to try hard this year to reclaim that number one spot. And I think they can do it. I'm not saying they will, but I think they have the people and I think they have the producers to do it if they want to.
And now we also have, of course, the cable networks to deal with. CNN just announced today, for example, that they're going to name their new morning show New Day. Jeff Zucker is CNN's new president as well, been in the job for a couple of months. Give me your prediction of how morning television will look like in 5 years. Will it be completely different to what we know today?
I don't think it'll be completely different, but I think there will be even more competitors, and I think it will be much more internet-oriented. I'll tell you what I mean by that. I personally wake up every morning with my cell phone. I roll over, I look at the screen, and I see what happened overnight. Did anything bad happen overnight? I know if anything bad did happen, I'll get a news alert about it, or I'll get a tweet about it. And as a result, I don't need the morning shows to give me that update about the world. What we want from morning shows more and more is a family or a group of friends to wake up with, companionship in the morning. And that means chemistry matters more than ever between the anchors, between the reporters that are on these shows. I think we'll see that emphasized more and more by these shows. Not that they'll downplay news entirely, but if you're getting the news headlines on your smartphone or on your tablet or on your computer, these shows will have to be more and more about the news behind the news, or have to be more about entertainment in order to attract an audience.
Brian Stelter there, author of Top of the Morning. That was an interesting interview, Phil, I have to say.
What do you think our personalities are like? Do
well,
they work?
I think,
are we like Matt Lauer and Ann Curry, or are we a bit better?
I don't want to speculate which way around that should be attributed, but what did fascinate me about this is that clearly he's written a book, it's got mass market appeal, so Mr. Stelter has to go on shows like this, but more importantly, to him, I suspect, shows like Breakfast TV in the States. So this week he was actually in the awkward situation of being on Good Morning America, saying, and of course sometimes the anchors don't get on, and clearly they're like, no, we get on just fine, don't we, Gary?
Well, it was interesting, because in the book he got the most access to Good Morning America, so they actually let him follow around the crew, the anchors, for several days. So he was very kind to GMA.
So he was friendly with them.
He
okay.
was, but he hasn't actually spoken to anyone, any of those executives at NBC and at the Today Show since he wrote that book as well.
Ouch.
So very interesting stuff. You're listening to Midori House here in London. After this, we'll be heading over to Cairo.
The Review is Monocle 24's weekly review and preview of the arts. Every Saturday, we take a relaxed look back at the books, TV shows, films, music, theatre, and events that have made our week, while looking around the corner to scout out the next big thing.
It doesn't feel sappy, it doesn't feel sentimental. It does have a certain heft.
It's very Darwinian. The shows that do well run and the ones that don't close. And there have been some quite high-profile flops and some great successes as well.
For me, it's riotous, it's tasteless, but it's actually dynamic as well. It has momentum.
Join Monocle's editors as they sit down with our favourite critics, opinion makers and key industry figures for some in-depth discussion and lively debate. And we provide inspiration for the weekend from cities around the world.
It's a real divider because I know some people just love this film and other people really just hate it.
That's A Review, every Saturday at midday London time and across the weekend, right here on Monocle 24.
And welcome back. You're listening to Midori House with me, Phil Hahn, and Dominic Reynolds. The time is, it's 8:45 here in London, which means it's 9:45 in Cairo, which is where we're going to head to now to check up with some of the stories making headlines there.
Indeed, Abdelrahman Hussein is our man on the ground, and he joins us on the line now. Abdel, welcome back to Midori House. Lots going on in Cairo today, most notably the million man, what's planned to be a million-man Labour Day protest by leftist workers. We talked about that on The Globalist earlier on, so we won't spend too much time on that one. Let's instead start by talking about the nuclear non-proliferation talks in Geneva.
Egypt's walked out of these meetings.
Yes, Egypt has walked out of the talks in Geneva, citing frustration at the inability to implement a 1995 resolution to make the Middle East a zone that is free of weapons of mass destruction. Egypt's ire is mainly aimed at Israel, which refuses to sign the treaty or acknowledge its own nuclear program.
Presumably, there's not going to be a lot of movement on Israel acknowledging its nuclear program. We've been here before. So where does this process go now?
It doesn't go far, I think. I mean, there's also kind of a delicate balance with Iran as well. And Egypt has long complained about the Israeli nuclear program. And I think this is just a show, like a symbolic walkout. I don't think it might push things in the direction that Egypt wants it to go.
The U.S. and Israeli officials have said that a nuclear arms-free zone in the Middle East could not be a reality until there was really broad Arab-Israeli peace and Iran curbed its nuclear program. It doesn't seem like that is going to be on the horizon anytime soon. So moving forward, what comes next? This has been a process that's been going on for a long time. Will it just continue plodding along?
I think it will, actually, because I think matters with Iran seem to be at a stalemate as well, and I don't think there'll be any movement or traction in that direction. And as long as there isn't, then Israel can dig in its trenches and maintain. But the issue here is that Israel is the only country in the Middle East that actually does have a nuclear, I mean, although unacknowledged, but it's the only country that does have developed nuclear capabilities. There is no Iran up until this moment. There is no proof that it does have it. But as long as there's a stalemate on this side and a stalemate on that side, things will stay as they are.
Talking economically about Egypt, that IMF loan is still unsigned. Workers are complaining very loudly today, in which case the stopover of Qatar's PM would likely be of some interest, given the potential wealth that could be flowing from Qatar to Egypt.
Exactly. Qatar has already given $5 billion to Egypt since the revolution in various guises. I mean, $3 billion of it was a deposit in the Central Bank of Egypt. Now, Egypt's looking for another $3 billion in bonds, but Qatar is demanding a 5% interest rate and an 18-month maturity rate, and this has proved a stumbling block. However, Egypt looks like it's going to back down and accept the deal as it is with the terms that Qatar has instilled. And because the IMF loan seems no further Egypt is looking for other avenues to shore up the economy.
Is this a new strategy for President Morsi, and namely the Egyptian government, which is to perhaps bypass the IMF loan arrangements and shop around in the Middle East to see whether they indeed can get the money that they want for a much better deal than the IMF are offering?
Well, they're definitely trying to, but this isn't the direction I think that will be successful. I mean, when Morsi assumed the presidency, he spoke about how our friends in the Gulf would help Egypt and invest in Egypt. But this isn't really how it's turning out. And the IMF loan, I mean, it's not really so much about the $5 billion that the IMF will give Egypt. It's more about the votes of confidence that will give, and the loan is a lot of foreign investment is contingent on the success of the IMF loan, and so for economic development in Egypt, the IMF loan is a very different ball game than going to Qatar and asking them to buy bonds.
While it struggles to shore up its economy, Egypt, of course, like many other countries in the region, is trying to clamp down on its tax evaders or even avoiders. And one such case involves two prominent Egyptian businessmen who have now sort of, there was a travel ban on them. There is no longer. What's been going on?
They've settled the tax disputes with the government. The company in question is Egypt's biggest listed company, Orascom Construction Industries. And it was charged with evading $2 billion in taxes going back to 2007 sale of its subsidiary, Orascom Building Materials Holding, to the cement giant Lafarge on the stock exchange. Now, this has been a very contentious issue because Morsi, before the tax authorities chased Orascom Construction Industries, Morsi had alluded to their tax evasiveness in a speech that he gave a couple of months back. The thing is this, there's been a lot of debate over whether the move was legal or not. What happened was that Orascom sold the subsidiary on the stock exchange in order to avoid paying capital gains tax, which is legal in Egypt. However, there's also political issues at stake. And the family behind Orascom, the Sawiris family, is a very big Coptic Christian wealthy family in Egypt. And there were other kind of insinuations of other things going on. However, obviously, the Egyptian government just needs money in any way that it can, and it's going to go after people it thinks evaded tax in some way. But they finally settled at $1 billion, and so the Sawiris family have agreed to pay that, and that seems to be the end of the matter.
Abdelrahman Hussein, speaking to us from Cairo, many thanks for your time.
There is an Australian in the building. Adrian Craddock will be here to run us through the Australian newspaper headlines, which have caught his eye very shortly. But first, taking us there, they're from Melbourne. There are four of them. They're called World's End Press, and this is Second Day Uptown.
Stuck in the elevator with the ghost of Christmas past. He's telling me just what I've lost. I jog the block as quick impressions flick around in me, but I can't seem to join the dark. I'm a man and I've got reasonable abilities. Trying hard to remember every part of me. Whatever happened.
And they are from Melbourne. That was World's End Press with Second Day Uptown. But from Melbourne, it is to Perth we go, because that's where our next guest is from. He is Adrian Craddock, our resident Australian. He's brought with him some of the Australian front pages. Hello, Adrian.
Hi, guys. How are you?
Yeah, good.
Excellent.
Good. We always love hearing your Australian accent.
Oh, that's very kind of you. That's a nice way to start.
And the interesting things it says, of course.
Of course.
What's the first interesting thing it's going to say today, Adrian?
Oh, geez, no pressure. I'm just looking at the West Australian. It's not a paper that gets a lot of airtime on this station.
Yeah, it's not one we talk about often.
But hey, let's not deter it. It's a great, great paper. Mm-hmm. There's a story here about Bali. And basically, a woman from Perth has been subject to a sexual assault in Bali. And it's sad in a way, because Australia has got this massive love affair with Bali. It's our most popular tourist destination. And if you look at the headline here, it just says Bali attack, big bold letters, and a shot of quite a dank, kind of depressing Balinese villa. Mm. And it just seems like our love affair with Bali is coming to an end. I mean, it's not that long ago. It reminds me about 2 months ago, there was a front page story that was across all the Australian front pages, which was talking about a young guy who went drinking in Bali, surprise, surprise. And basically was slipped some ethanol in his drink and suffered quite serious poisoning and ended up passing away, which was extremely sad. And I think this is just the latest in a long line of incidents that's leading to us kind of falling out of love with Bali.
Because parts of Bali, if you're in the tourist parts, it literally feels like you're in Australia.
It really does.
There's just Australian bar after Australian bar, Australian surfers, families. But I'm just wondering, looking at these kind of recent events, how much of it do you think could potentially just be a bit of scaremongering from the media? You know, we had the horrible attacks in Bali from 2002, which really killed quite a large number of Australians. But that didn't necessarily translate into Australians completely turning their backs on that as
a
destination.
I think it would be drawing a bit of a long bow to say that Australians still, you know, think about that when they're going to Bali. I mean, that was some time ago, and I think we've kind of moved on from there. I think part of it is cheaper air flights. I mean, a lot of people are going to the US now. It's become a little bit more economical to do that. And you can see it in the numbers. I mean, if you look back, I think the numbers from March show that there's been a dip of 9% of Australians visiting Bali. So, yeah, it's...
Okay, so concern for Balinese hoteliers, of course. Run us through another story quickly.
Okay,
we've got a bit of time left.
Okay, sure. Let's head to the Australian now. And the longest election campaign in Australian history. I mean, it's the election's coming up on September 13th. It seems to be kind of kicking off as far as campaigning goes. And Labor have announced their big kind of slogan. It's stronger, smarter, fairer.
Wow, it's almost exactly like an Olympic slogan. It's almost as long to start up the process as well. Adrian, I'm going to have to cut you off there, I'm afraid. That's just the way it is, because it's almost the end of the show. It was produced by Alan John. Our researchers were Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Annabelle Bly. And Chris Fitch was the man at the desk as studio manager. Next up after the news is our weekly show, The Menu, with Marcus Hippi.
And I'll be back with Midori House at the same time tomorrow with Clemency Burton-Hill.
But now, from me, Dominic Reynolds.
And from me, Phil Hahn. It's bye-bye.
A Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives: that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.